Hi, I'm Francesca Rhiannon, host and producer of Writer's Voice. Rutgers University historian Donna Murch is a contributor to the forthcoming collection of essays, False Choices, The Faux Feminism of Hillary Rodham Clinton. It's edited by Liza Featherstone and will be published by Verso Press. Murch's essay, The Clinton's War on Drugs, When Black Lives Didn't Matter, explores the origins of the Democratic Party's turn to the right, exemplified by the Clintons both in Arkansas and in the White House, and the policy of mass incarceration they did so much to accelerate. Murch spoke with me for nearly an hour in a wide-ranging interview that covered not only mass incarceration and its impact on communities of color, but also why older black voters are supporting Hillary Clinton in large numbers and why younger black voters are going overwhelmingly for Senator Bernie Sanders. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and a long clip from this interview aired first on my weekly radio show and podcast, Writer's Voice. Donna Murch, welcome to Writer's Voice.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Your article, which was first published in the New Republic and is now a contribution to False Choices, The Faux Feminism of Hillary Rodham Clinton, it's titled The Clinton's War on Drugs, and you make that a plural. There are those who say we cannot blame Hillary Clinton for policies that were carried out under her husband's administration. So I just wonder if you could, right at the start, tackle a little bit of that issue. How do you see this as something that the responsibility for can be laid at her feet as well as her husband's?
The reason I chose to call it the Clinton's Wars on Drugs is that in many ways, as a first lady, Hillary Rodham Clinton had an unprecedented involvement in all aspects of policy. In fact, when she ran for senator, that was one of her major points of emphasis, that her political experience came as first lady. So I think that that's been core to her own political strategy from the very beginning, prior to her presidential run, but going all the way back to her campaign for senator for New York. So she's used repeatedly this phrase, strength and experience. And so she talked about, you know, her involvement in healthcare reform and criminal justice legislation. And of course, as we've seen from the video clips, she actively came out and campaigned for the crime bill in 1994. She made statements about the war on gangs, referring to youth as super predators. So she was very much an activist first lady who saw herself as a policymaker. And I think that you can't have it both ways. You can't both claim the experience in policymaking as being in the White House while your husband was president, and then say, I don't have responsibility for the legislation that was passed during that period.
So you begin your article referring to an incident that happened in August of 2015 on the campaign trail in New Hampshire. Tell us what happened and what Hillary's response was to that and why you found that response so telling.
There was this remarkable event that happened in New Hampshire where you had Black Lives Matter protesters, rank and file members, come and confront Hillary Clinton on the campaign trail. And Danya Yancey approached Hillary Clinton and said, "You and your family have been personally and politically responsible for policies that have caused health and human service disasters in impoverished communities of color throughout the domestic and international war on drugs that you champion as First Lady, Senator, and Secretary of State. So I want to know how you feel about your role in the violence and how you plan to reverse it." And one of the fascinating things about this confrontation is that Yancey and the other Black Lives Matter protesters use the language of personal responsibility. Doesn't your family have personal responsibility for their impact on the African-American community? And what was so striking about that is that the Welfare to Work Reform Act in 1996, the Personal Responsibility Work Act, had that language contained within it. And I thought this was a very powerful and symbolic way of taking the racialized and punishing discourse of personal responsibility, inverting it, and then applying it to the Clintons themselves. So she was also making the argument that Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton should be seen as a team. And so she talked about these in terms of family policies. So this was bringing together a criticism of the importance of the Clintons to mass incarceration with the effects of the really the elimination of welfare as we knew it in 1996.
Yeah, I want to get to what the impact of those of those policies were. But before that, you know, after that, Clinton met privately with Black Lives Matter activists, and there was a long discussion that ensued. I wonder if you could comment a little bit on that. I mean, there were those who said that, you know, she was really listening to them.
Well, I watched that footage over and over again as I was working on my article, and I think through a portion of it, she was listening. I mean, it had that quality of the way that presidential candidates listen. Listening, I think, is more of a performance than an action. But one thing that was clear is that there was a rising sense of impatience on the part of Secretary of State Clinton. And at one point, she said to them, "It's your job to tell me. It's not enough to protest, that you have to figure out what kinds of demands you want to make." And I think that that was fair enough. But again, it inverted relationships of responsibility. So she was placing responsibility on these young protesters, many of whom may not even have been alive during the passage of the crime bill, for them, rather than, you know, expressing her own platform for how to undo mass incarceration, how to undo the war on drugs. And I think that that's her responsibility as a presidential candidate.
She also said something about how she didn't believe that you could really change people's, you know, racist ideas, and that the only change that you could make would be in the policy area.
Yeah, well, I think that there are ways in which the Clintons, both of them, are really quite brilliant politicians. And they've been able to build very strong networks and patronage networks, including those in the African-American community. However, if you go back and you reconstruct the history of the Clintons' rise to power, it's very clear that they emerge out of a moment in American politics after this massive defeat of the Democratic Party by Ronald Reagan in 1984, where 49 states are vote Republican, and the only state to go Democratic was Walter Mondale's home state of Minnesota. So the Clintons, really, their vision of politics grows out of this backlash and fear about the Democratic Party's irrelevance. And at the center of this was an anxiety about the loss of white voters, especially white working class voters, but really white voters. And so the Clintons become part of the Democratic Leadership Council, and they make direct and veiled appeals to white populations in a moment where the country is moving right. So it doesn't surprise me that Hillary Clinton would say you can't change people's minds, because to put it bluntly, I think that the Clintons for many years have been able to pander to racist ideas while still building patronage networks among African Americans, which is a testimony to what sophisticated politicians they are, and also cynical.
So, in fact, you're saying that they've used racialized politics, what people refer to as dog whistle politics, to, on the one hand, pander to white voters, and on the other hand, pretend as if they're not doing that. You know, Bill Clinton was, what, the first Black president?
That's right. Toni Morrison used that title in a piece that she wrote. And it's important to note that she wasn't literally calling him the first Black president. It was reported speech of things that she was hearing said tongue-in-cheek in Washington, D.C. And it referred to that the kind of backlash that Bill Clinton faced, you know, the investigation into his sexual impropriety, the intense focus on his physical body, that this replicated forms of racism that African Americans themselves had been exposed to. But it also had another meaning, which is that the Clintons were brilliant at manipulating the racial symbolic. So on the one hand, they really outflank the Republican Party from the right. And they do this through dog whistle politics, through tough stances on crime that we can talk about in more detail, from opposition to welfare, and appropriating some of that very hardline rhetoric of the Reagan and Bush eras. So I think that they did this while at the same time incorporating Black people into the inner circle. You know, they opened up as the national outreach director for the Bernie Sanders campaign, African-American outreach director. He pointed out that the Clintons opened up political consulting to African-Americans. So they threw a lot of bones to Black political elites, and they engage in the racial symbolic. Bill Clinton went on the Arsenio Hall show, put on a pair of Black Ray-Bans, and played the saxophone. Now, what I think is important to note about that is its historical context. This is after 12 years of relentless assault under Reagan and Bush, of the constant use of racial racially coded terms like the welfare queen and the brutality of the Reagan era. So simply to have a president, in particular a white Southern president, feel comfortable with black people, I think that we forget how bad the 1980s were. So even having kind of social intercourse, Vernon Jordan was one of the Clintons' best friends. Seeing black people in the Oval Office, seeing them as an integral part of the inner circle. Historian Clarence Lussain has called this black faces in high places. So the politics of appointment and consulting among black elites was very important, combined with a deep knowledge of popular culture. So they can engage the racial symbolic, which made them appear to be very intimate and friendly with African Americans, but to support policy, particularly punishment and mass incarceration, what we would call carceral policies, and anti-redistributive, anti-welfare policies that had a devastating effect on black poor and working class people, as well as all poor and working class people.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with historian Donna Murch about her article, The Clintons' War on Drugs. It appears in the forthcoming book, False Choices. So take us through a little bit of this history of how the Democratic Party went from, you know, I mean, I remember the Johnson years, the war on poverty. Johnson, it may not be understood by many people, really reached out to the grassroots on the community level to put into effect his war on poverty. And so much of that got undone, as you point out, in the Reagan years, but also under the Clinton years. So tell us, how did the Democratic Party turn away from its roots and become the party that could allow the policies of mass incarceration and the war on welfare?
Well, you know, right now there's a real interest and movement inside the university to try to explain the origins of mass incarceration. And there's new research coming out, and some of it is surprising. The most surprising thing of all is that mass incarceration was a bipartisan program, that particularly for those of us that came of age under Ronald Reagan and remember the viciousness of Reagan-era rhetoric, we've all associated mass incarceration with the Republican drug warriors. So starting with Richard Nixon's declaration of a war on drugs in 1970, and then most importantly, Ronald Reagan's declaration of a new war on drugs in 1982, with its really vitriolic rhetoric and its discussion of violations of posse comitatus and the need for an internal war, using the language of domestic war to talk about American streets, and then, of course, George Bush Sr. So I think for many of us, we experienced what we thought of as the takeoff of mass incarceration as caused by Republican drug warriors. But as historians and political scientists have gone back to look at mid-20th century forward history of the United States, it's very clear that from its origins, Democrats were also involved in building what later became mass incarceration. So, for example, with the development of the Great Society and the War on Poverty, Johnson also simultaneously declared a war on crime. And many of the origins of the Great Society grew out of anti-juvenile delinquency programs. Now, to put this in context, because I think it's very important, every country has its own political culture, political rhetoric, and political constraints. In the United States, war is really a mobilizing rhetoric. You know, Susan Sontag wrote a brilliant essay on war as metaphor right after 9/11. But war has been used to talk about both progressive redistributive policies like the war on poverty, but then also the punishing policies about the war on drugs, the war on crime, and the war on gangs. But the war on poverty and the war on crime actually come together. They begin at the same time. And you do see Democratic support for mandatory minimums in the 1950s at the state level. So liberals had an important role to play in anti-crime early on, you know, 40 years before the Clintons. And one way that we might understand this has to do with racism in the United States, that the anxiety around African Americans, that the idea of African Americans as criminal and as threatening, is core to the origins of the United States. So one thing that's happening in the early years after World War II is that we're seeing this mass migration out of the South. So the majority of the African American population In the early part of the century, 80% of the black population is living in the South. But as they migrate north and enter northern cities, there's a lot of anxiety about shifting demographics. And one of the core responses to the changes in black settlement patterns is a call for more policing, more surveillance of youth. And that is some of the origins of what we see in the 1960s. Now, that said, I think that the war on poverty was incredibly important. It provided monies to grassroots organizations. It was called maximum feasible participation. And the idea was that the best way to solve the problems of poverty is to have the poor themselves participate. So in unprecedented ways, it invited poor and marginalized groups into policymaking to help shape and create policies on their own. And I'm also a historian of the Black Panther Party. And one of the things that the Panthers do in Oakland is try to get involved in running the anti-poverty councils. So I think that that was a very exciting time. But it's almost like waiting in the wings. In order for liberals to make compromises and to win support for redistributive policies, they had to make concessions to war on crime. And so some of the infrastructure that gets built during the war on poverty, the youth services bureaus that Elizabeth Cai Hinton writes about in her new book, From the War on Poverty to the War on Crime, institutions that are set up to function as community resources. As the country moves steadily right, some of this infrastructure is actually used in the war on crime. So I guess the short answer would be that the war on crime was bipartisan. There's no question that the new right that Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, and George Bush were foundational in this. And the anxiety in the Democratic Party after the incorporation of African Americans into the Democratic Party, you have, you know, what Republicans called the creator of the strategy called this Kevin Phillips, the Southern Strategy. So you have the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party couldn't be seated in 1964. But once African Americans are seated in 1968 in the Democratic Party, and we really do see kind of a important change, electoral changes in the structure of the Democratic Party. They develop a caucus system in order to make the party itself more responsible to different constituencies like African Americans and feminists, Hispanics. I would use the term Latino, but they use the term Hispanics. So they restructured the caucus system. So important changes did take place, and I think the Democratic Party did become more democratic, small d. But at the same time, you begin to see the white out-migration from the Democratic Party into the Republican Party. And given that the African-American population is roughly 10%, and Latino populations are much smaller in this period, you know, there was a sense of political crisis of we're losing our base. You know, the base of the Democratic Party had been white Southerners, you know, whites in the South, and then had been, you know, northern working class urban populations. So there's a kind of a crisis that gets created where they're trying to recapture white voters. And I think that this helps increase what historians and social scientists have called dog whistle politics, and the most powerful one is crime. So you begin to talk about crime as a stand-in for talking about African Americans, and this started not after the urban rebellions, but going all the way back to the 1950s, that the Dixiecrats were always calling civil rights workers criminals. So the combination of that, the criminalization of civil rights, and then the criminalization of urban protests. So you have a series of urban rebellions that take place from Birmingham in 1963, really through the King assassination in 1968, in which hundreds of thousands of people participate. And the federal government's response to this is to pass the Omnibus Crime Control Bill. And these were essentially protests that were demanding that African Americans have access to social and economic rights. So there's a constant dance back and forth. On the one hand, trying to recapture the white vote, and this is true in the late 60s and early 70s, and it's certainly true in the 1990s. And on the other hand, it's the constant recourse to crime and symbolic politics as a way to represent race without directly naming it.
So now bring us up to the Clintons and the whole way in which the DLC began to reconstruct the Democratic Party around this kind of dog whistle politics.
One thing I wanted to add is that, you know, recently, just a few weeks ago, the wonderful journalist Dan Baum came out and was interviewed and talked about the statement by John Ehrlichman, one of Nixon's advisors, who said that we saw the real problems as blacks and anti-war protesters, but we couldn't make it illegal to be black and we couldn't make it illegal to protest against the war. So we decided that one of the best ways to fight these populations was to criminalize marijuana as a way to attack the anti-war movement, and to criminalize heroin as a way to attack African Americans. And this is something that as a historian, that this is how I've always taught it. Of course, I'd read Dan Baum's book, which came out in 96. So it wasn't a new revelation to me, but it was wonderful to hear that enter the mainstream, because I do think that the war on crime and the war on drugs were political projects that targeted specific communities. So to fast forward to the development of the Democratic Leadership Council, when I was asked by Liza Featherstone to write about the Clintons and the war on drugs, I started to go back and to think about this period that I had lived through and to think about the Democratic Leadership Council. And I had thought about initially the Democratic Leadership Council more generally as this shift right that happened in the 1980s. But when I went back and looked at the periodization, what I was struck by is that, as I mentioned, you have this overwhelming defeat in 1984. And so there's like a crisis within the Democratic Party, and they're trying to figure out what to do. So the first wave of new Democrats are led by Al Fromm, and you have a lot of Democrats coming from the kind of the Central South, coming from Oklahoma, from Virginia. And their primary interest is that they felt that the Democratic Party had become too beholden to these new constituencies, to its new caucus structure. So what they wanted to do was strengthen the power of elected officials within the Democratic National Committee itself, and to bring it closer to corporate donors. So it really does start with an attempt to kind of bring big money into the Democratic Party. And it's part of, I would argue, a larger international problem of, same thing happens in Britain with the Labour Party, you know, of moving kind of corporate and moneyed interests closer to what historically had been Labour, liberal-based parties. So that was the first wave of the DLC. Then what happens is that in 1988, you have a presidential campaign with Michael Dukakis running against George Bush. And you have, I think, our most notorious example of the use of dog whistle politics, where Michael Dukakis opposed the death penalty. And one of the things that Ronald Reagan did was, you know, you had a whole movement against the death penalty in the 1970s, was to bring back the death penalty. And the death penalty had this deep symbolic racial politics. So, of course, if you think about it, it's state-sanctioned murder. And in a history like the United States, with a history of racial punishment, of lynching, that the death penalty was incredibly loaded because it was the ultimate expression of state power. And as we all know, overwhelmingly, it was used against African American men. So the death penalty itself is very, very loaded. So essentially, Michael Dukakis, who is a liberal, he opposes the death penalty. And compared to the rest of the Democratic Party, he was relatively liberal on criminal justice reform. So there was a convicted felon who was released on a weekend furlough program. His name was Willie Horton. And after being released, he raped a white woman and assaulted her husband. And George H.W. Bush, his campaign manager, Lee Atwater, gets a hold of this and essentially uses it, starts running blitz campaign ads showing Willie Horton and essentially saying, this is what Michael Dukakis wants. Mm-hmm. And the consequence of this is that Dukakis, who had been ahead of George Bush in the polls and was actually quite popular, was defeated. And many historians have argued that George H.W. Bush was the first candidate elected fully on an anti-crime platform.
So Bill Clinton himself also embraced the death penalty.
That's right. So Dukakis is defeated, George Bush is elected, and I'd say this is where we see the second stage of the Democratic Leadership Council. So it starts with big money and trying to strengthen the power of elected officials, eliminate the caucus system. But after 88, it really accelerates, and this is where Bill Clinton becomes actively involved in this. Bill Clinton's own history as governor of Arkansas reflected this shift right. So in his first term as governor, he actually commuted in the 70s about 40 people from the death penalty, and he ran as a liberal. Hillary Clinton was working for a relatively liberal law clinic. And he was defeated in his second election. And one of the major issues that was used against him was his liberal stance on the death penalty. So that defeat for him was a very bitter one, and he took it to heart. And after that, he commuted no more death sentences, and he took a much harsher stance on crime. And the place where you see this most clearly is that when he was running for president for his first term, right before the New Hampshire primary, he flew back to Arkansas to preside over the execution of Ricky Ray Rector. And Ricky Ray Rector is this tragic figure who was incredibly troubled from childhood. He shot a police officer, then afterwards tried to commit suicide, shot himself through the temple, and essentially destroyed the frontal lobe of his brain. Many people estimated that he had an IQ of 50 or 60 and the decision-making power of a child of 5 or 6. He was so impaired that reporters who interviewed him the night before his execution noted that he told them that he wanted to vote for Bill Clinton in the fall and that he was saving his dessert for the following evening, not able to even understand that he was being murdered. David Garth, the political kingmaker in New York City, said, what could be tougher than murdering a man with half a brain?" So Clinton, again, the understanding of the political symbolic, whether it's playing the saxophone on Arsenio Hall or what it meant to preside over the death of Ricky Ray Rector right before the New Hampshire primary, I think that this was a political and a tactical choice. And throughout their career, both Bill and Hillary have been very tactical politicians.
Now let's talk about the famous crime bill. The 1994 crime bill. Actually, there was an op-ed in the New York Times today by a number of writers.
Let me give you their names.
Yeah.
By Vesla Weaver, Jalili Kohler Hausman, and Elizabeth Kai Hinton.
Yes, in which they also take this up, in which they talk about how the Clintons have said that it was black people themselves who advocated for that 1994 crime bill. First, tell us a little bit about what the crime bill accomplished, if we can use that term, and why there was opposition to it, and what kind of opposition there was.
So the Notorious Crime Bill, as it was called, its official title was the Violent Crime and Control and Law Enforcement Act. And essentially what it was a federal mandatory minimum law, but it contained many things. It was a federal three strikes bill that established a $30.2 billion crime trust fund to allocate monies for state and municipal police and prison expansion. So it was vastly expanding the amount of money the federal government was giving both for police and for prisons. It also helped to accelerate punitive policies at the local level. So the statistic that we often cite when talking about the Clinton's crime bill was that under the two terms of Bill Clinton's presidency, 600,000 people were put in prison. Now, the majority of those were put in prison at the state level. And of course, we can't hold the president responsible for state-level incarceration. But what I would argue is that the kind of climate that was created, and this is true throughout the wars on crime and drugs, they really, like Nixon's declaration of the first war on drugs, these were executive-sponsored policies where they were top-down policies that came and then flowed down into different portions of government. So the kind of extreme punitive rhetoric symbolized by the embrace of the death penalty, because another important part of the Violent Crime and Control Act is that it added 60 new different offenses, including nonviolent offenses, drug trafficking offenses, to federal law. And a number of people, I think 99 people were killed, were given that federal death penalty under the Clintons. So this was just a massive push forward for the mass incarceration state. And there's something else that I'd like to respond to. One of the criticisms that I got from my article was that the Clintons did not invent mass incarceration. And I would say that is absolutely true. The origins of mass incarceration lie in the mid-1970s, and they have earlier precedents, so there's a strong bipartisan element. But this is what I would say, is that like many state policies, mass incarceration was a process. it didn't just start one day. And if you look at it as a process, the most extreme acceleration in terms of number and punishment actually took place under a Democratic president. So I want to stress that mass incarceration was a process, and also the federalization of the war on gangs and the federalization of particularly the use of conspiracy and a whole kind of setting up these networks for the collaboration between municipal, state, and federal law enforcement under the Clinton era really helps to explain the huge numbers of people that we see in prison. It wasn't new, but it was an acceleration of degree that was quite profound.
In fact, you say that under Bill Clinton, more people were incarcerated than under any other president before him.
That's right. Absolutely. More people were sent to prison at the state and federal level than under any of the notorious Republican drug warriors.
And what was the impact on Black communities of this?
Oh, gosh. The impact is just devastating. I mean, I think we have yet to fully even reckon with its impact. There are people that have likened it to genocide, understood in the context of massive loss of family, of whole neighborhoods. Heather Thompson has written about million-dollar blocks where whole portions of blocks have been incarcerated, and that cost of incarceration per year is over $1 million a year. I can tell a short little story about that from my research, which really struck me. When I first started researching my new book on crack and the war on drugs, I was doing interviews in Oakland, which is home of the Black Panther Party. And Oakland has always been for me a very special place because of its real political vibrancy. It's such an important place for all kinds of radical politics, queer, Black power, anti-capitalist, a variety of different types of radical politics. And I was interviewing one of the activists from the 1960s, and she told me about an event that happened in 2006 after Ron Dellums became mayor of Oakland. And Ron Dellums called in all of his old lieutenants, all these different political constituencies in Oakland, and they asked each group what they wanted. So you had business people, you had Black city council people, you had some of the unions present, but they also invited a group of youth activists who were roughly late junior high, early high school, 14, 15 years old, and they asked them what they wanted. And they said that they wanted grief centers. And the adults in the room were really dumbfounded, and they asked them what they meant. And they said, well, you know, many of us have been raised by our grandparents. Large numbers of our parents have been incarcerated. Some have experienced addiction. And now our grandparents are passing. And we, before we could even begin to talk about what we want, we need a way to mourn. And I listened to that. I thought about that for years afterwards, that a whole generation of people really were denied their parents. So when we talk about 600,000 people being sent to prison, and that's only including prisons, not jails, which have, you know, an even larger percentage. So I think that it has been devastating at the most intimate level. You know, I think the separation between parent and child is probably the most important experience, part of the human experience. You know, Gil Scott-Heron has this song, "Who'll Pay Reparations on My Soul?" And when I think about that, family separation, that to me is most serious. But of course, there are many different aspects of things we can talk about. You know, in many ways, people are being stripped of legal citizenship, stripped of the right to vote, stripped of economic citizenship, stripped of the right to work in the legal economy. Because essentially, to have a felony conviction means that you can no longer work in the legal economy. It's very, very difficult. And of course, the public health crisis of prisons, you know, hepatitis B, hepatitis C, all different kinds of communicable diseases and HIV, the rates for infection are much, much higher. So being sentenced to prison has all these different implications, both of the most personal, but also public health ramifications.
Wow, that's so profound to contemplate. So this had a profound impact on African-American communities in this country. In this current election cycle, the Clintons, both of them, I could say, Hillary as well as Bill, have said that the crime bill was something that was asked for by the Black community. So I wonder if you could address that issue. And that goes back to the op-ed that we spoke about that was published in the New York Times.
Yes, and I think this is such an important issue. So consistently, both Bill and Hillary Clinton have been arguing when confronted by Black Lives Matter, and especially by Black youth who are trying to speak to the effects of mass incarceration and to call them to account, again, using Donesia Yancey's words, your family bears responsibility. Do you accept responsibility? And so essentially their response to say, if I could paraphrase, is no, we don't have responsibility. The Black community itself has responsibility. So their argument is that you have to understand what things were like in this period. They were very, very bad. You know, people were dying in the streets. And Bill Clinton recently, several days ago, went so far as to argue that people in Black Lives Matter are defending gang, and these are his words, not mine, are defending gang leaders that sent out 13-year-olds hopped up on crack to murder other Black people. So he used this language that came straight out of the sensational media portrayals and also in feature films and on television, you know, invoking these racist images from the war on drugs and war on gangs. And a couple of things to say about this. First of all, the use of the term gang member. One of the things that happened in 1996 was the federalization of the war on gangs. And the war on gangs was a war on Black people, a war on Black youth. So I study, for example, Los Angeles, and as part of Los Angeles's war on gangs, by the early 90s, 47% of African-American men between the ages of 21 and 24 are designated by the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department as gang members. So we are truly talking about mass incarceration. So there's the desire to represent essentially these monsters, the super predator, you know, the quote from Hillary Clinton about the super predator, as these exceptional, you can't even call them human beings because what they're really doing is dehumanizing them and stripping them of humanity and making them into monsters. But what these policies really looked at on the ground were mass criminalization of Black and brown youth, of Latino youth as well. So in order to deflect responsibility for policies that really resulted in the incarceration of a whole generation of poor and working class youth, they've said that Black people themselves called for this. So the question is, how were they able to argue this? And one of the things that I think the op-ed piece today, did Blacks really endorse the 1994 crime bill, does very effectively, is that it talks about selective hearing. So essentially, in this period, we had, under the Reagan administration, a defunding of cities. So I can also use an example from the city of Los Angeles. In the 1970s, Tom Bradley was using 75% of social welfare programs for the city of LA were funded by the federal government. So Ronald Reagan comes in and cuts off all the money to cities. So we have this huge economic crisis. So the cities are being defunded. We're in the height of a recession, much like our subprime crisis of 2008. We had a savings and loan crisis, a financial meltdown. At the same time, this is really some of the worst impact of the outsourcing of manufacturing, where working class people are losing jobs. Mm. So there are very few jobs. There's very little social welfare support. And there was a genuine economic and social crisis in the 1980s and 1990s. And African-American communities were seeing rates of unemployment over 50% and at their most serious among Black youth. So it's in this context that we see really the search for employment and survival. And that was a real thing. But the Clintons are absolutely unwilling to talk about these in terms of real social consequences because they themselves took that anti-welfare neoliberal agenda of Reagan and Bush and expanded it. So the only way that they can talk about this is to use these overblown cinematic invocations of monsters instead of talking about the social crisis as a real thing. And the only solution that the state was willing to offer was punishment, prison, police, mandatory minimums, the death penalty for people involved in drug trafficking. So what the op-ed piece argues very powerfully is that they selectively curated and used particular Black voices in order to rationalize these punishing policies. So you had a portion of Black legislatures that supported it and a portion that didn't. But the larger context for this is that the real solution to social and economic crisis is social welfare, full employment, which many of the Congress people were demanding. You know, the majority of the Black community were calling for social welfare. We don't have jobs. We don't have housing, we have crumbling schools, and we have capital divestment. In order to help revitalize these communities, we need economic resources. But instead, what they were offered essentially was Operation Hammer. They were offered crushing, punishing policies. So the Clintons are selectively using Black supporters of these policies to represent what all African Americans wanted. That's the first problem. There's an element of tokenism, you know, of the selective choice of particular voices. But secondly, they're ignoring that even the people that supported the crime bill, many of them were calling for expanded social welfare provisions, and all of those were dropped. The Congressional Black Caucus offered its own alternative crime bill that had much larger social welfare portions, and it also contained a series of measures to prevent racist application of the death penalty, and those were dropped by the Democratic leadership.
So let's talk a little bit about other approaches to the issue. We are speaking now just a few before the New York primary. Bernie Sanders was also confronted by Black Lives Matter early on. Maybe you could just mention if there was any difference in the way that he dealt with the protesters who came to his rally. And what has been his approach as his campaign has evolved to the issues of mass incarceration and racial justice?
Bernie Sanders early on was approached by members of Black Lives Matter, including one of the founders, Patrice Cullors, who's from Los Angeles, and others who were upset about his failure to talk actively about the importance of Black lives and state violence against African Americans. He initially was very defensive, and I would say didn't respond well. But in the longer term, what was interesting was seeing the Sanders campaign, I think in a way, as traumatic as that moment was, it was a gift to the Sanders campaign because it forced him to reckon more directly with race. And this is where demographics matter. So Bernie Sanders is a senator from Vermont, which is literally one of our overwhelmingly whitest states. I think it's something like 97%. It's in the high 90s. So it has a very, very small population of color. It's a very liberal state, but it's very small. It's very white. It's also comparatively poor compared to other states. So I think that what's complicated about that is that Bernie Sanders identifies himself as a democratic socialist. And I think those kinds of politics would be very hard to be elected as a senator from almost any state in the union. So that's some of the contradiction and complexity of American politics. He comes from a liberal New England state, which makes it possible to be a democratic, to run as a democratic socialist and to actually use the S word.
Although actually there are quite a number of conservatives. I mean, there's a large conservative portion in the state because there are many rural voters, and they have also gone for Bernie Sanders over the years.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
How do you explain that?
Oh, I explain that because he's a real retail politician. I mean, he has gotten things done. You know, people talk about Clinton getting things done. She didn't do a whole lot for people who she was representing in New York State. But he really does. He goes all over the state. It is a small state. He finds out what's going on locally. He deals with it locally. I mean, somebody told me yesterday, who was from Vermont, that when the storms came in Irene, he was like there before the rain even stopped in communities, getting money for those communities. So he has shown that he cares, he listens, and people have responded. I mean, he is the most popular politician in Congress. He's got 83% approval rating in his state. And there is a vast number of rural folks there, and they support him as well.
Oh, that's so interesting. Just saying that, you know, Bernie Sanders comes from a state that's, you know, overwhelmingly white. And I think that that also is important in thinking about the confrontation with net neutrality. At the time, I was a little bit perplexed at the public nature of the confrontation with Bernie Sanders and not with Hillary Clinton. The confrontations with Hillary Clinton came later, and they were largely done by grassroots rank and file members of Black Lives Matter, not by the leadership. But net neutrality, one of the founders of Black Lives Matter, was there and was central to the protest. But looked at in hindsight, I think it was a gift to the Sanders campaign because as a result, he developed a racial justice platform, which I've read. And one of the most interesting things is, and I recommend this to people, to go look at the Bernie Sanders website and look at his racial justice platform because it's structured literally around the idea of violence. And not only physical violence, it talks about forms of economic violence, police violence, and it's interested in the intersection between these different kind of the political economy of exclusion and then links that to an analysis about police violence in prisons. And I thought that was quite radical. I've never read that kind of policy framing from any politician. In many ways, for me personally, the Sanders campaign harkens back to Jesse Jackson's presidential runs in 1904 and 1988, because what I remember those campaigns vividly, and I remember the Democratic National Conventions vividly for the same reason, because you were seeing things that you had never seen before. So seeing Spanish spoken on the stage, seeing the lambda, silence equals death, at the height of the AIDS crisis, where you saw the parameters of American politics being expanded. And that's what I see going on with the Sanders campaign, the very direct engagement with Wall Street, an analysis about the centrality of the financialization of the economy to the effects on people's everyday lives. So you often get a very kind of evacuated populist rhetoric where people talk about the interests, but the particularity with which Bernie Sanders talks about financialization and its manifestations, and he includes that in his discussion of violence. And I think that given Americans dropping wages, radical fall in living standards, the drop in life expectancy rates among white working class people, especially white men, is very telling. And I think he's most effective when he talks to Black voters, when he talks about mass incarceration. One thing that I would say, and for people that support Bernie Sanders, people of color that support Bernie Sanders in different parts of the country, one thing I have heard is that we'd also like to hear a broader discussion of issues that affect Black people than just mass incarceration. But I think that that reflects partially the history of the confrontation with Black Lives Matter. And Erica Garner, the daughter of Eric Garner, who was murdered by the New York police, she did an incredible spot that was really initiated by her and structured by her, that was talking about everyday lives and about her son and about a vision for the future. Because I think that the vision of a future, will we have a future, will we have an economic future, is a large part of what's driving so-called millennial youth vote for Sanders. And I want to highlight that within the African-American community, it's very important to disaggregate it by class, by race, by gender, and by age. You know, we've entered a time, and this should have always been true, but it's absolutely urgent now not to talk about the Black community. There isn't a Black community. Just like any community, we have many different, lines of difference. And one of the biggest places you see that electorally is in the Black millennial support for Sanders. So I was following very carefully the electoral outcomes and the initial vote in South Carolina, because that was the beginning of the whole, you know, Southern primaries and the question of how would Sanders fare. And it's very clear that overwhelmingly Black voters supported Hillary Clinton in very large numbers. And I think it's very important to take that seriously. I'm not someone who talks about the language of, you know, people being duped or not understanding. I think it's our job, you know, as journalists and as writers and analysts to interpret what happens. And what I see is that, number one, mass incarceration has been so destructive, partially because of the way it helped to fracture African-American communities. So in addition to what I talked about, the terrible human consequences of it, but I think that it really helped to heighten class lines. So you have lines that are not just about income or assets. You also have lines about legal status. Do you have a felony conviction or not? And those lines will run through families. There was a great deal of shame involved in people becoming incarcerated. So I think that the older generation of voters in particular didn't see themselves as affected by these punitive crime policies. But younger people are much more mobilized by this. That's why we have not only Black Lives Matter, but BYP 100, We Charge Genocide, Hands Up Unite, Million Hoodies. I mean, I could go on and on about all the different youth-based organizations that are fighting mass incarceration and people that were animated and mobilized by the shooting of Trayvon Martin and by the acquittal of Darren Wilson for killing Michael Brown. So for the younger generation, this is incredibly important and animating. And one of the exciting things is I was in Ferguson, both observing and writing what was happening. And it was very exciting to see people who have had felony convictions actually come out and talk about that without shame. So I think there is complex dynamics going on in the African-American community around the crime bill and mass incarceration and what their relationship is to it. I think there is a problem, one, of reporting and getting good information about what really happened. You know, as Gore Vidal said, we live in the United States of amnesia. So that's not particular to African Americans. That's a larger problem. Two, these issues that I've talked about, the very complex relationship that African Americans have to mass incarceration. And we're in a moment of change where it's an issue that is being acknowledged and we're seeing people mobilize against it. And that's one of the reasons that you have a huge number, especially of Black women academics, but Black academics more broadly, who have come out and very actively criticized the Clintons for their record on mass incarceration, the war on drugs, and on welfare reform. So I think there's a kind of Black left coalition that's supporting Bernie Sanders very strongly, combined with Black millennials. And in South Carolina, you saw, while Hillary Clinton won overwhelming numbers of Black voters, 46% of Black millennials supported Bernie Sanders in a very conservative state like South Carolina. So I think that there's kind of an interesting change that's occurring. And I see the Sanders campaign as knitting together this interesting mixture between Black millennials, Black left academics, the left of the labor movement. So there's a whole portion of the Sanders campaign that did outreach to Black workers. So you had Larry Cohen coming to Birmingham to support a state level $12 minimum wage. And I just saw today, which I'm very excited about, that the TWU, which is the Transportation Workers Union for the MTA, that they're going to come out and endorse Bernie Sanders. And this is a very heavily Black and multi-ethnic Black, you know, African-American, West Indian, Caribbean union. So I think there is actually a very interesting coalition that's being knit together that I think of as a cross-generational Black left coalition, with a lot of emphasis coming from both working class people and then a lot of people like the people that I know who come from working class origins but have been upwardly mobile and well-educated but remain closely tied to where they come from.
Do you think that that coalition can then reach upward and both age-wise and class-wise to reach other Black voters who are now so behind Hillary Clinton? You know, I mean, I have to say I was very shocked at John Lewis, for example. You know, it seems to me that Bernie would have been the natural person for him to support. So help us understand a little bit about how Hillary Clinton has been able to have so much loyalty among some of the old icons of the civil rights movement. And then also that second question, do you think that Bernie can reach out to those different sectors?
Well, I think John Lewis is an excellent example. One thing I would add that I discuss in my article is that John Lewis joined the Democratic Leadership Council in 1990. That's very early. So 2 years before Bill Clinton is elected. So he signed on to the DLC very early. And I think looked at in a larger historical frame. You know, my first book was about the Black Power movement, and there were many different tendencies in the Black Power movement, but one of them was an electoral tendency. And so it was the idea to take this newly found voting rights, and not only the right to vote, but to have people to elect. And this is not an unusual dynamic. Certainly you see it in South Africa with the African National Congress, of populations that when they're shut out of the state, they're unified, and it creates a coalition among people that normally would not come together. So you have black elites that are shut out of power. But you know, social movements are not only damaged by repression, they're also damaged by incorporation. And I think that you can't understand John Lewis without that as an analysis. What happens when the man who's unable to give his speech about the importance of jobs and economics, by fast forward to 2016, is talking about people, as someone termed it, had gotten in touch with his inner Ayn Rand, you know, is talking about people supporting Bernie Sanders because they want things for free.
So then maybe just black voters. Do you think that that Sanders can enlarge his reach among the black community beyond black millennials?
My hope is that. That's why I'm very excited about the TWU's endorsement. I think organized labor, most of organized labor, the leadership has supported Hillary Clinton. But I think there's a lot of grassroots support in the unions for Bernie Sanders. And it takes me back, actually, to Occupy in 2011, because I was always going to those protests. And I remember there was a mass protest in November 2011, where you had all of the trade unions that came out, and huge numbers. And of course, we're reminded in New York City that the unions are heavily, heavily black. And to see that presence in New York City, so that's what I'm most hopeful for. We're going to see what happens with the TWU endorsement. So I am hopeful about that. But to be honest, I think that the generational divide is very, very strong. I have many friends, we'll say, from kind of the chattering classes, who are supporting Hillary adamantly. And there's not really much taking of tea. I think there was an attempt to discuss it early on. And to be generous, because I would also like to be fair, there are many people in my own family that are supporting Hillary, and I've had extensive discussions with them. And I think especially for an older generation of African-American women, and of course we know that black women vote at the highest percentage in the electorate. That's really important, because so many people think that, oh, well, these groups, you know, non-white groups don't get the policies they want because they don't vote. But it's actually not true. The single biggest demographic that votes are African-American women. So that also helps to explain some of Hillary's campaign strategy about the direct appeals that she's making to black women. And one of the things that I've heard from my older relatives that I think may be representative is that there was such a sense of excitement about the election of Barack Obama of this first. And even though people are not most people I know are not satisfied with what the policy outcomes have been under Barack Obama. Nevertheless, the politics of seeing a black man in the White House, but most importantly, seeing the racist mobilization against him that they see as having thwarted his potential success. So one of the strategies that Hillary has used from the very beginning is to drape herself in the legacy of Barack Obama and to say, well, when Barack Obama and I were in the Oval, you know, in the Oval Office, she says that all the time. And so there's an erasure, one, of what happened in 2008 with the fairy tale comments from Bill Clinton, another moment in which he comes out and says these things that seem very destructive. So the tensions between Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton, and Barack Obama, I think, have been erased. And I think she understood from the beginning how important the black vote was. So a lot of people feel, of this older generation, that supporting Hillary is a way to continue the legacy of Barack Obama. And I think that helps to explain the scale of support. The second thing is that, and I've heard it from my own aunties, that they really want to see the first woman president, that they see a parallelism in the same way they saw the election of the first black president. So this for them is the continuation of firsts. And to be fair to them, I think that they see this in democratic terms. So democratic small d, that, you know, African-Americans have always seen and arguably have always represented the left of American politics. So they see this as an extension of democracy, of saying a woman can be president. So for the older generation, I think that that does matter, that she's a woman. And I think that's a part of the reason that they are supporting her.
Any last words?
I'm really excited about Liza Featherstone's anthology. One of the things that was really wonderful about it was to have an opportunity to bring together different voices of women and women writers to interpret the candidacy of Hillary Rodham Clinton. You know, given the way that gender politics has operated in this election, particularly the punitive comments of Gloria Steinem, you know, that really demeaned younger female voters by saying that they're voting because they want to find a boyfriend. I mean, it's hard for me even to say this out loud and to say in a serious voice because it sounds like satire. But it was really nice to be part of a community of women writing critically about Hillary Rodham Clinton. All of us are deeply invested in feminist politics and, you know, politics of womanism and the importance of women of color also. So I was very happy to be a part of this dialogue to respond to Hillary Rodham Clinton's candidacy.
Well, Donna Murch, thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice. These issues are so important, and this has been a very illuminating discussion.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
That was historian Donna Murch. She teaches at Rutgers University, and her work centers on issues of mass incarceration and the history of Black social movements. Her essay, The Clintons' War on Drugs, When Black Lives Didn't Matter, is included in the collection False Choices, The Faux Feminism of Hillary Rodham Clinton, edited by Liza Featherstone. It'll be published in June by Verso Press.